Okay, this is Rag Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. And if you don't know, we come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. On KOOP in Austin, or at least we originate. We're syndicated. We originate on KOOP 91.7 in Austin. Co-op is a solar-powered, all-volunteer, cooperatively run radio station. It's a very cool place, and I think that it's unique in the country. So, and I know that we're unique in the country. So, and we're also rebroadcast on a number of other stations around the country, and our podcasts are posted all over the place. So if you miss all of this, you can catch it later. So, my guest is Jonathan Lerner, who I haven't seen in many, many years, except that I'm seeing him now on Skype. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm fine, Thorne. Nice to have a look at you.
Yeah, it's great. Long distance and with a delay, but it's wonderful. A long time delay, actually. So.
Yeah, 47 years, maybe.
Yeah, something like that. Okay, Jonathan Lerner is the author of Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American Revolutionary, which, according to OR Books, is the true story of an intellectually adventurous gay man immersed in the macho, misogynistic, and confrontational environment of the Weather Underground. And it's interesting because Mark Rudd said, this is the closest you'll ever get to being there. So it's a fascinating book, and it's an incredibly good read. Whatever you think of you know, whatever position you have on the Weather Underground and what happened. And I think everybody, you know, it's like there have been a number of memoirs written by former weather people, and all have slightly different perspectives. And some are more forgiving than others, or more apologetic for what happened than others. And there's lots of different views, and there's lots of different perspectives. And this book also involves Jonathan's history as a closeted gay man, partly closeted, who came through this whole process and didn't actually come out until later in his life, and who's now happily married. So all that's true, right?
All that's true.
Okay. Jonathan Lerner dropped out of Antioch College and became a full-time activist on the staff of Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, the principal organization of the New Left. He was a founding member of the militant Weatherman faction, which took over SDS in 1969, and editor of its newspaper, Fire. And he also ran the national office, which was in Washington, D.C., which I was
in Chicago, actually.
Oh, in Chicago. I'm sorry. You were in Washington later. Yeah, well, because I was in the national office many times, so I should remember.
Right.
He remained a member of the Weather Underground while it carried out a campaign of bombings until its demise in 1976. He is the author of the novels Caught in a Still Place and Alex Underground, and a journalist focusing on architectural, urbanist, and environmental issues. He now lives in New York's Hudson Valley with his husband. I don't know what, it seems like this book has gotten pretty positive reaction. And I think it's very interesting. And you and I share the experience of SDS, you actually got involved a little later than you're slightly older than I am, or younger than I am, about 4 years, I think. And, mm-hmm. And I was thinking about what an incredibly different experience that was, even those 4 years. Because I got involved, I joined SDS in 1963, and you got involved like about 4 years later, right? I believe, is that right?
Yeah. And I think, there was clearly a generational divide within SDS, and I think it was a function of how the situation in the country had evolved in those 4 years. Basically, the Vietnam War from 63 to 67 went from being obscure to being obsessively dominant in everybody's face all the time. And SDS's evolution, I think, mirrored that because, largely prompted by the draft and the threat of being drafted, thousands and thousands of young people, mostly students, got drawn into SDS to protest the war. And that wasn't really true in the earlier period of SDS, when I think it was more focused on civil rights activism and economic equality.
And of course, I was not the first generation. You know, there was already, because, you know, the original Port Huron Statement and Tom Hayden and Todd Gitlin and whatever, all of the folks that were, Al Haber, the folks who were originally involved. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I was even involved, there were also the older people, you know, the older guys. But I think what it does, what is different is the experience. I was involved before there was all this sectarianism, you know, and there were always, and I was totally immersed in it, you know, in SDS and the RAG, which we published in Austin from 1966, was virtually an SDS project. I mean, everybody that was in, that worked at the RAG was also involved with SDS. Of course, SDS was a larger group than just the membership, as you know, and as you mentioned in the book. It's, you know, there were always a lot more people involved than actually were formal members. But it was a major force. I mean, it was the primary force in the country, I think, certainly student-oriented force in fighting the Vietnam War.
I think so, too. Certainly by the end of the 60s it was. And as you say, I mean, I believe that the membership never topped 15 or 20,000, the actual paid membership, but hundreds of thousands of people would have considered themselves either members or friends of SDS and would have been involved in activities and actions and demonstrations that we organized.
It's amazing to me because even here in Austin, of course, I'm back in Austin. I was in Houston for many years and in New York.
Yeah.
But I'll run into somebody just at random in some situation and I'll for some reason my history comes up and they say, "Oh, I was in SDS." And it's nobody I ever saw before it was also a national community, which was another important aspect of it. And so it was connected. Everybody was connected. The underground press helped make that happen, throughout the country, but everyone was connected.
That was actually a remarkable thing about SDS that you felt, I mean, I didn't join until 1967. I had never even really been involved when I was in college. It was after I dropped out of college that I got pulled in. And immediately I felt that I was part of a community that was national and part of a movement that was national. It was a very kind of welcoming. I mean, I guess I got in on the last moments. Sectarianism was just starting to make the atmosphere nasty. There was still that kind of welcoming, freewheeling, anybody can carve out any project and do it kind of spirit. And that pretty quickly, by 68 and into 69, very rapidly deteriorated into kind of poisonous factionalism.
And my involvement, actually, I was in Houston then. We started an underground paper called Space City in Houston. Mm-hmm. And at the time that all of this was unfolding, we still identified with SDS, but I had gone to every national event, every convention, every national and at this point, I just stopped being involved in the national organization. It just felt poisonous. And a lot of people who say, and this is an interesting question, actually, we ought to jump back and give a little more context, but I will throw this one thing in. A lot of people blame, and I think in your book, you're nuanced about it, but I know people who absolutely blame Weatherman for the end of SDS. And technically, I guess it certainly is. But I think that it was ending before that. And I think there were too many.
It was going to split apart one way or another. We were the people who sort of seized the electric cord and yanked it out of the wall, basically, and like let the organization physically fall apart and abandoned the national office and abandoned the membership.
Right.
If some other faction had taken over in the summer of 1969 when we did, they might have killed it in a different way. But I think there was too much internal strife and too much interference from the FBI and
COINTELPRO
too much
was
just
a,
kind of right. anxiety all around in the in the culture.
Yeah, and it was a changing of the guard. The war was ending. A lot of the things and people were, a lot of the people who had been involved for a while were growing older and suddenly realized they had to have some kind of a life, because most people who got in SDS just got involved, or people who were really involved. Okay, let's The book is amazing. I think it's very, very interesting. I know there are people who will disagree with a lot of with some of the specifics, but like I say, everybody has a different perspective, and your perspective of weather underground is a little different because you weren't part of the hardcore exactly. You ran the national office. You were kind of a, you know, you did a lot. You were kind of a connection, and you were involved. I mean, you were deeply involved from the beginning. But you weren't a part of the actual collectives that were doing the bombing and that kind of thing. So you're looking at it from a different.
Really,
go ahead.
I had a sort of oddly solitary path through it, even though it was a very sort of cultish collective oriented organization. But I was kind of a lieutenant, not a leader, and I most of the time. Both before we went underground and during the time we were underground, most of the time I was actually not in one of the collectives, even though I was still a participant and involved in some of the activities and supporting people who were underground.
Okay, give us a little context. How did it really come about? What were the forces that made it happen?
Okay, so we were talking about how the tension around the war was escalating toward the end of the 60s. The tensions in race relations were also escalating wildly. There had been in the summers, especially in 67 and 68, and 68 after the assassination of Martin Luther King, there were enormous eruptions of rage in Black communities. And at the same time, you had very militant Black organizations like the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army emerging. So there was a kind of crescendo building just in the culture around these political conflicts. And then also within the left, there was the development of these battles between factions to try and articulate what the right path forward was, what we should be doing. And within SDS, there were three main factions by the time SDS split apart. One was a Maoist organization called the Progressive Labor Party, who had a very kind of traditional working class oriented, quit school, cut your hair, go to work in a factory and organize workers kind of orientation. And then there were the other two factions who had been comrades, just a few minutes before, called ourselves the Revolutionary Youth Movement, because our general attitude was more, that the real possible active force among white people would be sort of alienated kids and greasers and Vietnam vets. And we weren't that interested in sort of traditional proletarian Marxist-Leninist kind of organizing. But that coalition that existed around this idea of a revolutionary youth movement also split apart, and Weatherman was one of the splits. We articulated this idea that it was really important for white people to do everything we could to create chaos and in any way we could weaken the state, and that would be a way to deflect some of the repression that was coming down on Black activists, and it would also be a way to hasten the end of the war in Vietnam. So we were really pugnacious and provocative in what we thought people should be doing. And once we took over the organization, which was in June of 1969, instead of continuing to run it as a mass student organization with all these 20,000 members, we just formed small collectives in half a dozen cities and started essentially picking fights with the cops, basically putting ourselves in provocative situations and thinking that sort of causing this kind of very visible, showy, chaotic, fighting-spirited activity was the thing to do. But actually, we were isolating ourselves as we did that.
Right. Okay. You know, we'll talk about the convention too, but I mean, because that's when it actually started. Well, why don't you say a little bit about that, about what happened at that convention, and even the stealing the election part of it?
Well, it was clear, I was one of the people, as people came to this convention, and let me just set a little context. All of SDS's conferences before had happened on college campuses, and, you know, either during Christmas break or right after, in June after students had left. And so we would be staying in dormitories and eating in cafeterias and going off campus to the nearby coffee houses. And there were lawns and benches and conference rooms. And it was all very kind of comfortable and lovely and what we were used to because we were middle class students, most of us. By this time, because of the militants of the organization and because of threats from the FBI, no college would host us. And so we held this convention in an arena on the poor black south side of Chicago. It was a kind of a seedy, grim building, badly lit. Two huge rooms side by side, sort of, you know, arena rooms with stadium seating. Echoey, hard to talk. There was no place to go to relax. I don't remember what we possibly ate. Probably we, you know, drank a lot of Coca-Cola and smoked a lot of cigarettes. So it had this kind of spectral quality just in terms of the aesthetics of the experience. And it was June and it was hot. I was had been stuck on a table outside on the sidewalk checking people's identification before we let them in. And that was partly to keep out members of what we called the bourgeois press. And it was also to try and keep out any police informers that we could identify. But I and another person from the Revolutionary Youth Movement were the people checking IDs. And we quickly realized that the Progressive Labor faction would win any election because we could figure out who these people were. So, I mean, the story of this convention is very detailed and very rich and very sort of crazy. When it came time on the last day of the convention to elect officers to run the organization for the next year, basically knowing that we were outnumbered, our side walked out from the big room to the smaller room. And basically, although we left the room, we said we have kicked PL out of this organization. And then we had an election in which the Weatherman faction vanquished the Revolutionary Youth Movement faction.
It's interesting. You fixed the election, essentially.
Yeah.
But it's, and I think this was your words. You said, we fiddled that election to protect the cool kids because we just couldn't stomach the nerds. But,
well, actually, Thorne, I was describing a year earlier when I also helped fiddle an election.
Oh, okay. I didn't know about the earlier fiddling.
For anybody who still remembers that SDS, its founding principle was participatory democracy, and its earliest slogan was "Let the people decide." By 1968, fully a year before Weatherman took over, I and several other people were on the ballot counting committee at the National Convention, and if we hadn't disappeared some ballots, two of the three national officers would have been members of Progressive Labor, and instead only one was.
So, okay, where you said we couldn't stomach the nerds, but we should also note that Progressive Labor was a democratic centralist disciplined organization that actually had taken it upon itself to try to take over SDS or to become a major force in it. So they weren't
and would have taken it over if we hadn't
taken it over.
Prevented them by basically undemocratic means.
Yeah. So a lot of complex moral issues there. So we need to take a break. We're talking with Jonathan Lerner. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. being wrong. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street.
I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Jonathan Lerner, who is the author of who was involved in the Weather Underground, SDS, and then the Weather Underground, which was kind of an offshoot or a takeover of SDS, is the author of Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American Revolutionary, which is highly critical of the Weather Underground. And it's a fascinating book. Jonah Raskin, writing in the Rag blog, said, "You might describe this memoir as a love story about a man who is carried away by the passion for revolution and secrecy. It's also, and this is what makes the book unique, a love story about a man in love with other men and mostly in the closet during the time he was affiliated with the underground." This has to be another force, a psychological force that was at play with you. One of the things that you had mentioned that you might like to talk about is kind of what are the forces that brings people into this kind of dynamic, the psychology of why people join groups and take risks, informs the weather experience.
Yeah, and well, I think of probably almost any political experience. My take in a word on the whole history of weathermen is psychological more than political, and certainly more than ideological. I mean, of course, we were a political entity, but there were hundreds of thousands of people who were militantly against the war in Vietnam and who were horrified and trying to do something about repression against Black activists and Black communities, for example. And only a very few of us crossed the line to do what we did, to be provocative and violent, and potentially injure people and also become so self-assured in our provocativeness and violence that we also alienated even the people who had been our close friends and comrades and co-conspirators recently. And I think the reason people make those decisions mostly unconsciously is because there's something they need to get out of it or something they need to prove. In my case, now looking back, it's obvious that because, you know, this is before Stonewall, it's before gay liberation as a big visible movement. And so I grew up in a time when, you didn't talk about it and it was scary. And if you did talk about it, you were liable to get in trouble. And, it was easier for me, paradoxical though it may sound, to right at the time of Stonewall in June 1969, for me to join this, pugilistic militant group of political thugs rather than, because it was a way for me to cover over my own fears about myself. And I think, you know, my story is particular, and I think each person's story is their own, but I think that everybody who, makes a decision to do something as radical as what we did has something going on besides the politics. I mean, of course the politics were there. I had the politics. Everybody had what we believed, and we all had our reactions to what was happening and our kind of burning desire to do something about it. But the particular choices we made were unique and individual, and that's because each of us has a unique psychology. And I can't tell you what the inner reasons were for each of the other people. I have some thoughts about some of them, but that's for them to come to terms with or become aware of if they ever can.
But you think that there was something about the people who got it. Part of it is being in the right in a certain place at a certain time.
Sure,
but part of it,
and this personal loyalties. You know, that we already were a sort of network of friends, a lot of us, and so there was. In my case, too, my closest friend was one of the central leaders of Weathermen, and so I was drawn by loyalty and wanting to, you know, still be close to him. I think there's a sort of constellation of possible non-political reasons why people take very consequential political steps. You know, it's something that I'm going to be talking to on some campuses to young people who are now so much motivated to become activists. And it's one of the things I really want to share is this insight that it's not an argument against action. It's an argument for self-consciousness and intention and knowing why you're making the decisions you're making.
Yeah, and that is certainly an issue right now, as especially around things like Black Lives Matter and around the issues of say Confederate statues and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. all the stuff that's emerged. Also, we've seen a growing ultra militant force, even on the left, the Antifa and other groups, and there's real debates about whether that action is counterproductive, or, you know, the street fighting man kind of approach, or mm-hmm. woman. So does it seem to have a special relevance now?
Well, it certainly resonates. I mean, I don't know that much about Antifa and the other sort of ultra militant people on the left, honestly, but it certainly, familiar to me. And I mean, I think the people who are already deeply committed to that kind of militance are probably the way we were. You can't, you know, probably beyond like a rational conversation about it. But I think lots of other people who are righteously angry about what's going on and who desperately want to figure out something to do could also be drawn into that kind of militance. And I don't think, as long as we live in a country that's as flawed as it is still more or less a functioning democracy, I don't think violence it has a useful place in political activism. I once did, but I don't now.
When we talk and along the same lines, you, of course, Weatherman made the decision to move a step beyond in terms of its involvement with violence. And, mm-hmm. you know, part of what we were looking at, and we have to always put this, I think, in the context of the fact of what the United States was doing around the world, what the United States was doing in Vietnam, and realized that there was maybe a little bit of hypocrisy in say, the press and whatever coming down on the violence of whether people when mm-hmm. there was such incredible violence, not only in Vietnam, but in Latin America, and in this country, you know, especially mm-hmm. in black communities. I think that's a context, don't you believe, that we have to also see the
Sure,
the
and actually another thing, I mean, there was violent repression in places like Latin America and Africa, but also there were militant and military insurgencies, anti-colonial insurgencies going on in Africa, and there were militant revolutionary guerrilla movements in urban guerrilla movements in places like Argentina and Uruguay and Chile, and there were rural peasant-based guerrilla movements in Bolivia and other places. So, you know, we felt that we were part of a global wave of change that was happening, and it seemed to be that militants, military action, guerrilla activity, clandestine activity seemed to be the thing that was the public mass activism sort of led to in all these different places around the world. And it seemed like a logical step for us to take. I mean, that's one more piece of context. It probably didn't seem like a logical step to take for lots of other people who were in the New Left. But
yeah.
that's where I think the personal psychology becomes interesting.
In a high level.
But, I mean, what was the difference between you and me, Thorne? We're, you know, you're a few years older, but we were in the same room a number of times. We were in the same movement.
Right.
You didn't, you know, you were a close observer, but you didn't take the steps that I took.
Right. Right. And
I
can't say. One thing that you mentioned in the book was that the first time that you got involved in sort of a violent confrontation, that you kind of, it brought out something in yourself that you didn't know was there, and that maybe you kind of not exactly liked it, but it fed something in you. And that's not an experience I had.
It was thrilling to feel that, oh, I could do something violent to another person, because it suddenly it kind of absolved me of the sort of guilt of having been bullied when I was younger, you know, and never having been able to respond as a fighter. I mean, I never was in fights. I got sort of punched a lot, but I never fought back. And so it was quite thrilling and in a way liberating to take that step.
Well,
very seductive.
And I think that there was also another thing that was probably a motivation for a lot of people is guilt for what we were what this country was doing, and not feeling any power, and any way to and that whole bring the war home concept was partly that we need to be doing something here to fight that, and so it's in some ways understandable why logically a violent militant force would emerge. There's a logical progression there.
Yeah. I mean, I think what we lost track of was the possibility of militant activism that was short of violence, militant pacifism, or there's a lot of things we lost the nuances of, and that's one of them.
The Weather Underground, originally Weatherman, and then Weather People. There were a number of different.
I think the word weather was in the name.
Was in it, and a lot of it. I don't think Bobby Dylan would take responsibility for it, but a lot of imagery came from popular music, shall we say. The idea of terrorism, and you even suggest in the book that what the Weathermen did, and the Weathermen actually claimed no intent to harm individuals, right? To harm humans. I mean, maybe later on that, but primarily it was to do symbolic actions in the beginning.
Well, in the very beginning, it was unquestionably terrorism, because very early on in March of 1970, three of my former pals blew themselves up in a bomb factory. And they were building a bomb that they were...
An anti-personnel
bomb they were going to take to a military dance.
Do you think they would have done that?
I think so, yeah.
Really?
And
because I never...
I mean, they were making the bomb. And they weren't playing around in order to have the bomb blow up in their faces. They were trying to make the bomb.
Understood.
And I had been involved in conversations in the months before that, you know, were the same kind of, like, very... kind of nihilistic. You know, we had this idea that creating chaos was going to be a good thing, and it just sort of randomly attacking white people would be a good thing. So after that accident in which three of our own people killed themselves, then the organization pulled way back from that and continued over the next 5 or 6 years to do symbolic bombings, but they were much more carefully planned. They weren't aimed at people. They were aimed at just kind of being a showy, really modest attack at like corporate headquarters, police stations. One was a bomb was exploded in the Capitol. A bomb was exploded at the Pentagon.
But they were done carefully so that people. Although you can't ever control totally that, but they were
right.
done.
They
so
were
that
very
lives,
careful, and yeah. to my knowledge, no one else was ever hurt. So, you know, if you want to like go back to the question of what were we terrorists, maybe by some narrow definitions of terrorism after we became clear that these bombings would only be symbolic and not be anti-personnel bombings, maybe we weren't really technically terrorists anymore. But if you think that, then it ignores the sort of ramifications of just doing something that is using explosives, just doing something that's clandestine and is violent and could, even no matter how careful you are, it could actually by accident kill a janitor or somebody who's in the building.
But I think what people mean now by terrorism, especially the way it's been in the international sense, is actions that actually are aimed at civilians to create fear, a larger fear. And so it's kind of a distinction,
we were and then we weren't.
Right.
To me, the more important question isn't exactly at what point we stopped or who argued for stopping or all that. To me, the important thing to look at in the history of the Weather Organization is that even after we became careful with those actions, we were still contributing to what I see as a sort of general escalation of the idea of like violent activity and the sort of desensitization to violence and legitimizing things like bombings as being a legitimate form of political activity.
I think it
depends on the context. You know, if you're really at war, if you're really living under a fascist system, rather than in a country where a sort of quasi proto-fascist person happens to be president and is doing a lot of damage. I mean, you know, it depends on the context, but there's no question in my mind that we live in a much more, in a time when that kind of action, terrorist action, is seen by a lot of people, and unfortunately large number of people in different places, as a legitimate thing to do. And I regret to whatever extent we sort of helped contribute to the momentum of that, I think it's really regrettable.
You say you were never involved in any of those actions.
Not directly in any of the actions. But not by choice. I would have been if I'd have been asked.
Yeah, really? That's an interesting...
It so happened I wasn't asked. Yeah. I was doing other things.
Yeah. You know, the fact, to make a little leap, and we're talking with Jonathan Lerner, author of Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American Revolutionary. You talk about what happened internally within the Weather collectives, and I guess most of that is secondhand information because you weren't actually a part of those. I don't know whether that's a relevant point, but you talk about the dynamics between, for instance, you were working in the national office. You talk about the dynamics between leadership and people who weren't in leadership. You talk about the sort of cockiness that emerged, the sort of the you know, people who had been into sort of egalitarian concepts or, you know, approaches in the past suddenly became, I guess, authoritarian and certainly a machismo element developed. I mean, all the leadership was, except for Bernadine Dorn, the actual leadership, I guess, was male. And then there were the attempts at, for instance, quote, free love, at open relationships or whatever, but it always involved the men rather than women. I mean, tell me a little bit about all of that.
The period from early summer of 1969, when Weathermen took over SDS, until the time the organization went underground, which was only about a period of about 8 months, it was a really, really insane time. Because we had this idea of what we call creating what we called a white fighting force, and that like fighting and militants had to be the thing. We had this idea that people had to harden themselves, and we created a sort of centralist structure in which there were collectives in half a dozen cities of, you know, 10 or 15 people. With a leader and the designated leader, it was not collegial anymore. It wasn't a sort of round table where everybody had their say. It was a very top down kind of structure. There was also a sort of, part of this hardening was everyone sort of gave up every possible bourgeois value. You didn't have a car anymore. The collective had your car. You didn't have a checking account anymore. The collective took your money. You didn't have a bedroom anymore. You didn't have a closet anymore. You might be living out of a suitcase or, you know, sharing a mattress with two other people. It was a very sort of chaotic, unhealthy way to live. You know, forget normal meals or normal sleep. People often stayed up late into the night or all night having kind of meetings and what we called criticism self-criticism sessions, which were kind of a form of sort of psychological breakdown for individuals. And all of these things actually are sort of aspects of cults. And we didn't call ourselves a cult, but I actually think, looking back, that we met a lot of the criteria of being a cult.
Okay, we need to take a break.
Okay.
Things are running along so fast, we may have to do a second show at some point.
Okay.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. We're talking with Jonathan Lerner. We'll be right back. This is RAG Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. My guest is Jonathan Lerner. And if you're listening there, you realize that this radio station is very versatile. Sorry. And there's a lot of metal and whatever, and then a lot of beautiful bluegrass and all different kinds of music. And it's designed to serve all underserved communities. But it's a very progressive station. Anyway, that's just a note. Jonathan.
Yes.
Tell me about Bill Ayers, and I know I brought up the question of the supposed free love, which apparently wasn't totally free, and I don't mean that it cost something, but you had, I think, and it was rare for two men to get together, if I understand, but
it was rare,
and you had what seems like an interesting sort of series of interaction with Bill Ayers. And I think what it wasn't because he thought it was something I had thought at one time that everybody in the weather at one point was supposed to sleep with everybody else, even men with men, but apparently that's not true.
That might have been part of our public image. There were a number of sort of what we called orgies.
Yeah.
Events,
but that's
people were sort of freed up to kind of try to do what they wanted. So you would see more actually women, some of whom really turned out to be lesbians, getting together, and a little bit of tentative sexual interaction between men. The everybody sleeping with everybody thing was kind of a fact, but it was very much heterosexually dominated. But there was a brief sort of opening where people started talking about men having relationships with each other. Some men internalized that to mean, like, well, if we end up in jail for the rest of our lives, at least, you know, that's a way to have some kind of erotic life. Some of the men, there were actually other, I wasn't the only gay man, there were other gay men who were closeted, but who sort of took the opportunity to take advantage of the sort of relaxation of hostility towards homosexuality. And in the case of Bill and me, we were spending a lot of time together in Chicago, in and around the national office. We were friends. We had, you know, lots of, found ourselves many times in coffee shops all night long talking, and you know, it wasn't all politics. So we talked about our personal lives. And honestly, I mean, I couldn't recreate the conversations, but the conversations led us to have a couple of sexual encounters with each other, which were, you know, neither of us, I mean, I was gay, but I actually was completely inexperienced at being gay. And so was he, as far as I know. So, I mean, each of us had had a few like awkward connections with men in the past. And so, the thing that was, good about this connection was that it was eyes wide open. We were talking about it. We were both sort of present in it. I was probably expecting something more permanent to come out of it. And I think, I mean, I'm not sure what Bill's motivation was. And I haven't spoken to him for a long time, so I wouldn't want to like put thoughts in his head, but, let's just say he and I did not become boyfriends after that.
Right. okay. you say that you haven't spoken to Bill. Bill Ayers and Bernadine are both friends, and and they've been very, very, I mean, they've done great work since then. I think both of them very important progressive work in especially in education. And they've been very supportive of what we do, and both of them have been guests on my show a number of times. But I'm curious about how the interaction between you and, say, Mark Rudd, who also came out with a critical memoir, and people who haven't really kind of come to terms with that as much.
You mean what?
Or do they? I mean, there was a reference I read to being a turncoat. Are there people who think of you in that way?
Oh, there must be, I'm sure. You know, here's the thing. It was a small cultish hothouse organization that eventually split apart amid a lot of acrimony and accusations of who had done what wrong. And people sort of flew off in all kinds of directions, and some people retained friendships and connections and some people didn't. I mean, the way I say it is that I have one very close friend who came through that experience with me. There's a number of people I'm fond of and see rarely. There's another number of people who I haven't seen in 45 years. And if I did see them, it would be fine, you know, pleasant. And then there's another bunch of people, if I never saw them again, it would be too soon. So, but that's just because, you know, people's lives move on. I mean, haven't not been much of an activist for years. I've built a career as a journalist, and I consider my work political in the sense that I talk about things that are important and give voice to some people who otherwise wouldn't have it. But you know, I haven't encountered people at, you know, in political context because I haven't been involved in organizations. People are coming out of the woodwork now that I've published a book. I've had more contact with people from that history lately than in the past. You know, Kathy Wilkerson, who's a person who came out of that, it was Kathy Wilkerson's father's house where the bomb factory blew up. They were borrowing his house while he was on vacation. It turns out she lives fairly close to where I live. And after many years, many, many years, we saw each other. We've seen each other a couple of times, very warmly. And I was having lunch with her not long ago when we were sort of talking about our feelings to our ex-comrades. And I said, well, you know, I think the reason I could write this book and have such a pleasant time writing it, because I did, actually, it was a huge amount of fun to write it, it's because I'm not angry at anybody anymore. I've forgiven everybody. And I think she was taken aback when I said that. And then I spent a few days thinking about it. Well, have I really forgiven everybody? I was very angry at a lot of people at the end, and that anger smoldered for a long time. But you know what? I've forgiven myself. So it would be kind of hypocritical.
not to forgive others.
which doesn't mean that I necessarily want to make best friends with everybody either.
Yeah, yeah. But I think forgiving yourself is the first step, maybe, in some ways.
Yeah.
It's a key step. Okay, we're down to less than 5 minutes, about 5 minutes. Time just flies when you're having fun, doesn't it? but there were a couple of things that you had wanted to talk about, and I see them as kind of overlapping, I guess. You said what might have been different, what was lost when we kicked SDS into the gutter, and you also said whether forces led to the demise of SDS, but we sort of talked about that a little bit. And you said what you would like to tell activists of today. So I guess sort of thinking about then and moving forward, and I do like the question about what would have happened if SDS had continued. But
there's a really fast answer for that, which is that less than six months later, was Kent State and the eruption of, I don't know how many hundreds of campuses.
Right.
And suddenly there was no more central national office. There was no more phone call. There was no more coordination. And there was no more Students for a Democratic Society. I think you don't need any more illustration of what could have been a value to if we had maintained SDS.
Yeah, the only national coordination was through the underground press at that point.
Yeah, that's right. And that was, an era before we had all this centralizing technology. I mean, there was coordination, but communication was a slow thing 50 years ago.
Yeah.
As far as what I'd like to share with new activists or younger or people who are now the age that we were then, one thing, maybe the primary thing is the thing I said before about really trying to know what your intentions are and what your motivations are. I also think I'm concerned about a lot of the people who are newly immobilized having a very kind of stark sense of what's happening in the country because they're so justifiably upset and angry about what's happening in the country. But I think that there's a lot of sort of inchoate strategic free activism going on. In the first couple of months after the inauguration, there was a demonstration every other minute. And the thing is, this stuff didn't start with Trump. It's not going to end when Trump is no longer president, however that happens. It's going to be going on for a long time. The level of polarization is really, really challenging. And what it's going to take is a long sort of focused, committed, sustainable kind of activity, and burning yourself out by going to demonstrations every other day, every time another outreach happens, isn't necessarily a way to sustain your own activity. I'm concerned. I see that. I see a lot of sort of we've got to react to this. Now we've got to react to that. Kind of. It's good to step back and think in long term. In a long-term kind of way, and plan things. That's actually, I now see how things get accomplished.
Yeah. Do you think that SDS would have done better if SDS had a more coherent political philosophy and strategy? Because then so much happened. There was such a dynamic out there, and people were so close, and there was such a sense of collectivity and communality. That it didn't seem, and a basic sense of this kind of participatory democracy concept. But would it have lasted, perhaps despite all the sectarianism and stuff, if it had had a more coherent plan for the future even?
Maybe it would have, or if there had been a more sort of unifying principle and unifying leadership. But then sort of the beauty of SDS also was the fact
it was of its time.
Before those unpleasant last days was the fact that it was so wide open and any sort of anybody creative energy and ideas had a place there. So right. It might not have still been SDS.
That's right. So, okay. Thank you so much for being with us. Jonathan Lerner, author of Swords in the Hands of Children, Reflections of an American revolutionary. And I think this has been an excellent discussion, and I do think we should do another show sometime.
I'd love to do that. It's been great talking to you again, Thorne.
Okay. Thank you for being with us so much. Okay, I want to say that people who want to get in touch with us, I don't say this very often, all over the country, around the world, people who listen to us in different forms and through different platforms, contact us at, the easiest way is ragradio@koop.org. Give us feedback on our shows. If you have ideas for what we could be doing, let us know that too. Contact us at ragradio@koop.org. Okay, Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Thank you so much, Tracy, for being who you are. Susie Sheeler is here. Roger Baker is not here taking pictures because you would have to take pictures of a computer screen, and it's not as exciting. So I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. We'll catch you next week.